Today I want to ask you a question. let me start this way. How many of you know what your name means? Oh, wow. You're much more in touch with yourself in this service. That's good. Shout out. What are a couple of meanings? She of nobility. She of nobility. Wow. That's Patricia. She of nobility. I like that. Others? Olympic what? Blessed Mary, you know, Mary, that fits you. Blessed gentle waters. And Chad? Michael, which is guardian. Michael. Guardian. Yes. Today? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Now, yeah, back in the back, Heather? I'd vote we change the word shrub. Shrub sounds like something you want to, you know, take crossbow to or something, right? Flowering bush, native to Scotland. Not just any bush here, folks. Okay, yes? Little Christian. That's very cool. So, okay, here's the deal. Two weeks ago, I was at a wedding, and the most remarkable toast was given by the maid of honor, and it happened to be the sister of the bride. And she said, folks, did you realize that we're at a royal wedding? And I thought, well, I wonder where she's going to go with this. She says, referring to her now brother-in-law, the groom, his name is Ryan, which means a king. Kingly, and hers is Sarah, which means little princess. All right, now it got me thinking, we don't do this a whole lot. You actually do this a lot more than others, but there's a whole lot to a name in Hebrew culture. I mean, you name somebody, come, O come, Emmanuel. We just sang it, the worship team band led us in that. Well, Emmanuel means God with us. What a fitting single word description of Jesus. He is God with us. All right? Now, I want you to think about like really tough guy names for a minute. Okay? And there's some obvious ones. Steve, Trevor, Larry. You know, I mean, some clear. But you could throw in some, you know, Biff. I mean, that's got a lot going. Or Bo. I mean, hi, what's your name? Bo. Bo, that's it, Bo. Yes, that's it, Bo. You know, I mean, it goes places. Or how about this, Buck? Hi, my name's Buck. As in Buck Knife, right? I mean, you know, there's a lot of strong sort of manly names. There's T-Bone. I love this one, Hoss. Seriously, if you're a young couple and going to have babies someday, and it's a boy, think about Haas. Haas Cartwright, right? What's that? Bonanza. Man, that's a name. Now, here's one for you. How about Rocky? I know, right now you're thinking, are you kidding me? It was five sequels to that ridiculously horrible movie by Sylvester Stallone, and he was Rocky Balboa, right? But Rocky, that's a name. Let's give honorable mention to Sue. Thanks to Johnny Cash. How did he say it? Life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Indeed it isn't. But stay with Rocky for a minute. Pretty strong sounding name, I think. Rock. My name's Rock. If you think of things that are named Rock today, you got a energy drink, right? Rock Star. And then there's a new sort of a chain of coffee places, black Have you been to one yet? It's in the name, Black Rock Coffee Bars. So it's more than curious this morning then that Jesus, upon meeting a Jewish man named Peter, said, I'm going to change your name right now. You're no longer Peter. No offense to the Peters among us. You are now called Rock. In Hebrew, his name was Simon. In Aramaic, his name was, Cephas. Cephas. In Greek, his name, Peter, meant rock. In a sense, if you think about what you know from the Bible, just from the Bible, about Peter, one of the disciples, went on to be a pastor and an apostle, a letter writer, one of two letters he wrote, authored, when you think about what you know of Peter, you might be tempted to say, well, rock fits, as in rocky, not as in a strong, solid, granite-like name, but as in bumpy and iffy, like you would use in, you have a rocky start, okay? Because most of what you read about in the Bible leaves you kind of perplexed, if I may use the word. Perplexed that God would use somebody with his pedigree, with the credentials that Peter or Rock had. Leaves you kind of scratching your head. I want you to imagine this for a minute. Imagine for a second that God is interested in communicating information about himself. And it's really important stuff. This is not just, hey, I hope somewhere along the way people hear about me. No, no. He's so precise that he singles out individuals that will take a pen to paper and record precisely, exactly what he wants people to know about himself. They will not add to it and they will not omit from it. If you're interested in communicating in that kind of precision way, and indeed God is, then you have to start to say, how did Peter make the cut? How? And in fact, two letters in the New Testament bear his name. The Apostle Peter wrote 1st and 2nd Peter. But in time, Rock would come to describe the unbending, unchanging qualities that had been forged into his life to make him a very strong stone. Listen to this about a description of Peter the Rock. A rock isn't the prettiest thing in creation, or the fanciest, or the smartest. And if it gets rolling in the wrong direction, watch out. But there's no nonsense about a rock. Once it settles down, it's pretty much there to stay. There's not a lot you can do to a rock to change it or crack it or get under its skin. And barring earthquakes, you can depend on it about as much as you can depend on anything. So Jesus called him, Peter, the Rock. And it stuck with him the rest of his life. Peter the Rock. You could now quit fishing for fish. I've got a new assignment for you, and it involves fishing for men and women. He had been promoted. From there, he was no longer in the fish business. He was in the people business. So starting today, you can sense, hopefully in my voice, the excitement as we get to look at Peter. But my purpose this morning, rather than to begin to dig into the letter itself, is to help you begin to get a sense of who is this man, Peter. What was it about him that caused Jesus to single him out? What were his credentials that eventually led to Peter pinning the five chapter letter known as 1 Peter and also 2 Peter, that are near the back of our Bible. Let's start with some background. Peter was, at first look, sort of what I've hinted at already, a very unlikely leader. Okay? He's not a slam dunk. He did not graduate cum laude. He didn't do it. He wasn't the top of his class. He wasn't even close. In fact, he didn't go to school. Okay? So there's no honors or high honors or highest honors associated with Peter. He had, if I may say so, underwhelming credentials. A weak background. He was impulsive. Seemed a little slow, frankly. You look at him and think, you're a little thick, Pete. Did you get that? Did you understand what just happened? Are you in a fog, a little bit coma? What's going on? In a sense, you wanted to say on numerous occasions as you follow him along, well, wake up, Pete. Wake up. Not a likely guy. No formal education, not widely traveled. He was a simple fisherman. In short, he was pretty weak and prone to problems. Let me slow myself down for a minute and ask you a question. Do some of you think that way about yourself? You say, I didn't graduate summa cum laude. I didn't go to school. I'm one of those guys where I wonder, so far I've concluded God couldn't use someone like me. He uses special people. I think I see a pattern. He uses, and finish my sentence, but I'm not that. That doesn't fit me. I couldn't make a difference for God. And you're pretty sure it's a long shot at best that God could work through you. I don't know the reasons why you would be held back or hesitant, but maybe you blew it. Maybe somewhere in the past, there is a not-to-be-denied failure. You didn't manage a situation well. And maybe it left you thinking, okay, I'll just be a spectator, but I can't be in the game. God can't use guys like me. If you said that or thought things like that, I promise you, you're in for a huge, wonderful surprise. Huge. You hearing me now? In fact, write this down. Get your pen out and write this statement down because it's absolutely true, not just to Peter, but throughout the Bible, as you'll see just in a second. God's preferred choice of people, write this down. God's preferred choice of people is plain rapper people. God's preferred choice of people is just plain brown rap. Nothing special. Need proof? You and I could spend weeks reaching into the Bible and pulling out example after example. Take Abraham. Big deal? Yeah, read Genesis 11 and 12. God says nothing less than, Abraham, I'm going to make you the father of the faithful. Your followers, really my followers, will outnumber the sand of the sea or the stars in the sky. Are you kidding me? Yeah, that's right. You, Abraham. By the way, did you know this about Abraham? He came from a family of idol worshipers. That's right. He was from that forbidden group of his day. Read it. You'll check it out on your own. Let's go from Abraham to Moses. Absolutely, any study of Moses' life has to highlight the fact that Moses struggled with a speech problem. Every study says, He says in his own words, God, I can't talk. I can't talk my way out of a can. I'm a mess. You want me to be the voice? You want me to go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go? I got a tongue that's tangled up. I can't be the guy. And Moses becomes known as the most humble man to live on planet Earth. How's that for a credential? What if God looked at your life? Could he say something like that? You know what? Humble man, and he led my people to freedom. He's the standard bearer of humility. You think of humility, you think of Moses. Think of humility and you think of these words in the New Testament. God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Isn't that great? James 4:6. So you go from Abraham, you go to Moses. How about David? A short list couldn't be close to complete without a mention of him. So Samuel the prophet's given the assignment to go to Jesse, this man who had a lot of boys. And he's told, go find the next king. Saul didn't work out. Go find the man I've chosen. So Samuel goes and he meets this man, Jesse, and says, would you introduce me to your sons? And all the sons are standing there. And he goes by and he checks them off. No, this not this one, not that one, not that one, not one. Gets clear through the list. And Samuel looks sort of incredulous, like, really? Thinking, I'm sure there must be a mistake here. And he happens to ask, Jesse, is this it? Is this all the boys you have? And he goes, well, yeah, pretty much. Actually, there's one more, but he's out in the fields. He's a shepherd. Do you hear the comedy in that? He works with animals. These are men. He's out there. Samuel interrupts, hey, go get him. I want to meet him. In comes David. And God said to Samuel, he's my guy. He's my guy. And he's anointed and becomes the greatest king. Jesus was in himself, described himself as son of David. Huge. What do those three, Abraham, Moses, David, and this man I'm trying to introduce us to today, Peter, have in common? What was it that God saw in them that said, you, woman, you, man, doesn't matter gender, you're the one I want. I got one word for you, one word explanation, write it down, heart. Heart. What did they have that others evidently didn't have? They had heart. Listen to these words as Samuel the prophet describes that quality. 1 Samuel 16:7. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Would you stop with me for a second? Imagine the things that you notice about somebody else. Their hair, or lack of it. Their mascara. Their lip gloss. Their outfit. Their dress, their height, their age. Anything else I missed? I'm sorry? Teeth? Yeah. Do they have teeth? You know, what color? You know, that kind of thing. Right? Now I'm all self-conscious. Jeez, dude. Listen to this, 1 Samuel 16:7. The Lord does not look at those things that man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the, say it with me, heart. They had heart. So let's highlight a few facts about Peter and how God grew his heart. All this to help you better appreciate who we're about to learn from. Let's start with his resume. Peter was one of the first disciples called by Jesus. Most of what I'm telling you right now is out of Mark's gospel. Other gospels feed into this, but Mark, you can find, for example, in chapter 1, verse 16, that Peter had a brother. Remember his name? Andrew. So there's Simon, Peter, became Rock, and Andrew, his brother. They were brothers, and they were both living and fished in a body of water north of Jerusalem in northern Israel called Galilee. It's more correctly called a lake, like Lake Galilee. I've stood there. It doesn't really resemble a sea in size for sure. But it's known as the Sea of Galilee. That's where they worked. It was a freshwater body, and they fished it for a living. He was married. Did you know that? We're told in Mark's Gospel, again, chapter 1, verse 30, that he was staying at his mother-in-law's house. So we know Peter had a brother, Andrew. He was married. By the way, did you know that his name, Peter, is the only New Testament person named Peter? There's no other Peter in the Bible, in the New Testament. Interesting. Want more? Well, there's plenty more. He was one of, you could correctly call him one of the three in Jesus' inner circle. You know how somebody has how many of you have Facebook? How many of you have friends on Facebook? How many have lots of friends on Facebook? Okay, if you were to say, look, these are my three closest friends. Jesus picked 12, remember, the disciples. But Peter was one of the inner circle, almost always referred to as Peter and the two sons of Zebedee. Do you know who their names are? James and John. So it says, and Peter and James and John were with Jesus when he went into a room, closed the door, and healed that person. Or Peter, James, and John were the first guys to hand out the fish, the loaves of fish, the loaves of bread and the fish to feed the multitude. Peter, James, and John. Again and again, you hear that pattern. Peter, James, and John were on that mountain in northern Israel that day when Jesus was turned into something as bright as the sun called the Transfiguration. It happened with only those three. They went, that was Peter, James, and John, one of the closest in the inner circle. He had a special understanding of Jesus as well. My Bible's open to Matthew 16. Would you open yours there right now? Matthew 16, and I'll show you what I mean by a special understanding of Jesus. While you're turning there, let me tell you what's happened here. Jesus has sent out his men to tell about him. Upon their return, he asked them a simple, straight-up question. So what's the scoop about me? What are people saying? What's the news of the day when it comes to me? And you'll see that right here when Jesus asked that question. Some people say you're Elijah, you're John the Baptist, verse 14, Matthew 16. Some say you're Jeremiah, or maybe one of the prophets. And then Jesus gets more personal. What do you say? What about you? Who do you say that I am? At this moment, he's looking to the group. But Peter steps forward, as he often did, and says, I got an answer for you. Verse 16, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Look at Jesus' reply. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. You didn't go to school to learn this. This came to you directly from my Father in heaven. Verse 18, I tell you that you are Peter, and on this, here's the name change, rock, I will build my church, and the gates of hell or Hades will not overcome it. Wow, that's understanding. I know who you are, Jesus. I know it. I know you. You are Son of the living God. There's a dark side to Peter, of course. That's why I say Jesus, God's preferred people, his plain wrapper people. Did you know that Peter was a people pleaser? At times bordered on hypocrisy. Yeah, it's true. If you were to read, take the time, I hope you do, in Galatians chapter 2, 11 to 14, you will find that Paul, who wrote that letter, confronted Peter for this reason. Peter was sent by God. Peter, a Jew, was told, tell the Gentiles, talk to them about me. Peter was busy doing that until he looked up and saw some of his Jewish friends approaching. And he began to kind of quake in his boots and nibble his nails and wonder, oh my goodness, what will they say? What will they think of me if my Jewish friends see me hanging with Gentiles, non-Jewish people? So immediately Peter backs away from these Gentiles so that he's sure to be seen by his Jewish buddies as shunning this group of people. And Paul confronted him and said, how is it that you do this? That's wrong. Not only are you being hypocritical, but you're inspiring others to follow your example. So he struggled with that. And then I really want you to turn to the last, second to last chapter of Matthew, because I want you to understand what probably is the most known feature of Peter's life. Remember I told you it's Matthew 26. Remember I told you he's impulsive? Do you remember when they came to get Jesus and they arrested him? Put him in cuffs. I'm not sure what that looked like in that day. They came and they arrested his Lord. Remember the Bible's description of what happened next? It was Peter. He grabbed the sword and swung it, and I'm sure was disappointed that he missed because he cut off the ear of the man that grabbed his Lord. Probably wanted to take off his head. Didn't think, acted. Here in Matthew 26, he experienced devastating failure. Of epic proportion. Verse 57, after Jesus is arrested, they took Jesus to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. It's under the cover of darkness. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. Drop down to verse 69, and let's look at the outcome. Now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. You are also with Jesus of Galilee, she said. But he denied it before everyone. I don't know what you're talking about. Wrong guy. Verse 71. Then he went out to the gateway where another girl saw him and said to the people there, This guy, this fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. I know it was. He was. He denied it again, verse 72, with an oath this time. He made it very clear, I do not know the man. We said when I was a kid, put your hand on the Bible. He did that. Okay, he put his hand on the Bible. I don't know him. I have no idea who he is. Read further, 73. After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, surely you're one of them, for your accent gives you away. You sound like him. Then he began to spew expletives. It's not a pretty picture here. It was beep, 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 beep. He called down curses on himself and he swore to them, I don't know the man! And immediately, a rooster crowed. Could just see the blood drain from his face. And Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly, horribly. Raising a very contemporary question for us. What do you do when you fail? I know I'm looking in the faces of failures, just as you're looking in the face of a failure. I have failures in my life. What do you do when you fail? Are you finished? Take my toys and go home. Are you beached? You just go, I'm ruined. I'm done. Are you left paralyzed by the guilt? You are absolutely stopped in your tracks. I just forfeited my card. I am no longer a card carrier of this Jesus Christ. Maybe you're frozen by another kind of fear. I know what I'm made of. I might do it again. Question, when are you going to put your past behind you? If you failed, it's time to face, I failed. And put it behind you and forge ahead. It's time to get back in the game, isn't it? Isn't it? Don't listen to the cynic who said, if at first you don't succeed, so much for skydiving. You know why that's dumb? Because not all, in fact, most failure isn't fatal. It isn't. I want to conclude this introductory talk this morning to sort of present Peter by letting you peek at a parting conversation he had with Jesus. Jesus went to the cross later that next morning. Time passed, and Peter and the others went back to what he knew to do. He was a fisherman. So he made his way from Jerusalem, where Jesus was crucified, and traveled north to Galilee again. Found his way back to his roots. And that scene is described beautifully in John's last gospel. Would you go to the fourth? Or John's last chapter. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Please turn to chapter 21 if you would. I want you to see this incredible scene. Here's what happened next. Happened this way, Simon, Peter, Thomas, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, the two other disciples were together. Verse 3, I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, well, we'll wait up, we'll go with you. So they went out and got in the boat, but that night they caught nothing. I don't know what they thought at this moment. Hey, we used to do this and we were good. You know, it's been 3 years. I've given 3 years of my life to fishing for men, and I come back here and I can't catch a thing all night long. I get skunked. Early in the morning, verse 4, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. They're in the boat. And Jesus calls out to them, friends, have you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. They had to think, serious? The net's on the left, and you want us to flip it over on the right? For real? That's going to make a difference? And most fishermen would tell you, no, it doesn't change anything. Same boat, you're just going from the left to the right. But when they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John, who's writing this letter, this gospel. He said to Peter, it's the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it's the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off to fish, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards, a football length field. When they landed, they saw a fire burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. You've got to guess there's a flashback going on here. Remember, these were the disciples who were with Jesus when he said, hey, you see all those people? There's about 5,000, 10,000 of them. They're starving. Let's feed them. How are we going to do that? Loaves and fish. Okay, we got 5 loaves here. Little boy's got leftover food. We borrow his loaves, and we got 2 fish. And they were part of this miracle that unfolded in front of their eyes. Here they are again. Jesus says to them, verse 10, bring some of the fish you just caught. So Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish. They almost looked like perch, about 10 inches long. I ate one when I was there. And they're fresh water. 153 of them, but even with so many, the net was not torn. And Jesus said to them, come, let's have breakfast. None of the disciples wanted to ask the obvious question, who are you? It's perplexing. Why would they wonder, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Now this. When they had finished eating, wiping their beards, I'm going to speculate here. I'll bet Jesus and Peter had very little eye contact over breakfast. Mostly because of Peter. I can't look at him. I still remember the cock crowing. I can't. I'm stuck. Jesus breaks the silence, the awkwardness. Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? As he points to the other 10. Judas had hung himself. There were now 10. Do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord. You know that I love you. Jesus said, here's my job for you then. Feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? He answered, yes, Lord. You know that I love you. Then take care of my sheep, answered Jesus. Third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him a third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Then feed my sheep. I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. And tradition holds that he was crucified just like his Lord, only upside down. And then he said to him, Peter, follow me. Forget your failure. Forget all the reasons that you have been disqualified. Follow me. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. Apparently by now they were walking along the shore of Galilee. And John's there. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and said, Lord, who's going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, you want me to follow you? How about him? Jesus answered, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die, that John would not die. That wasn't true. Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, it's no business of yours. If I want him to remain alive until I return, what's that to you? This is the disciple, John's finishing comments. This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose the whole world would not be able to contain room enough for the books to be written about him. Are you getting this? Jesus asked Peter three times the same question. Do you love me? Corresponding to the three times that Peter denied ever knowing him. So Jesus instructs him, feed, tend, shepherd my sheep. Listen to me. Give the care in the gentlest way possible to my people. Because I love them. I want you to take care of my people. Pastor them. And he did. Chuck Colson spoke words that bear a striking resemblance to Peter's story. The former special counsel to President Nixon from 1969 to 73 was near the zenith of power. As he describes it, there was one door separating him from the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States. He had that kind of power, but because of crimes he committed while in that presidency, he was convicted and served his time as a federal prisoner. prison. This is his look back on his failure, his own words. The real legacy of my life was my biggest failure, that I was an ex-convict. My greatest humiliation, being sent to prison, was the beginning of God's greatest use of my life. He chose the one experience in which I could not glory for his glory. End quote. Peter's story would read similarly. He failed. He failed, but God had a new future for him. An unlikely pathway, but one where God has touched countless lives, including my own, with the wise and tender and timely and insightful words of the epistles bearing his name, 1 and 2 Peter. And now you're ready to learn from Peter, the pastor, and the very practical letter from which I've entitled a series, Strength in the Face of Struggle. Whether your struggle is living a holy life, chapter 1 is written for you. If you're trying to survive in a secular society, chapter 2 is written for you. If you're trying to endure a difficult marriage, chapter 3 is for you. If you're persevering right now in a painful trial, chapter 4 was written for you. If you're duking it out with the devil on a daily basis, chapter 5 is where you need to turn. Peter offers plenty to make us strong in the face of trial and struggle. I'd like you to bow your heads with me as we prepare to respond this morning. To you, God, our hearts are drawn. Sort of imagine myself at that seashore that day. Imagine feeling shock that you actually would single me out. You didn't insult Peter and you don't insult us. You didn't shame him, nor do you shame us. Do you want us to come to terms with our failure? So today I pray for us in this gathering who, like Peter, have reasons to conclude that we've been disqualified and are not fit for the kingdom. We're not fit to be in the game. We're not fit carry out a calling that you have for our lives. All of those are lies from the father of lies, the devil himself. If you're here this morning and today is just below the surface for you, that gnawing sense of, I'm Peter. I hear the echo of those words that Jesus said, you will deny me, that you ever knew me. And sure enough, you've done that. Maybe repeatedly. But you're saying, Pastor, if it's true what you're saying, that God uses plain rap people, and that God can have a redemptive outcome in a failed story like Peter's, I'm asking you today, pray for me. That's you this morning. I'm praying for you right now. God, please, do a work of reclaiming hearts in this place this morning. Cause us to see that we can go from failure to being used mightily. That our failure is not fatal. Write new stories, Lord, with the willing pen of people who are praying to you right now saying, God, I love you. I really do. And I'm willing to listen for your assignment to do what it is you're calling me to do for your glory and your glory alone. Let's respond to him in worship this morning.